I'm Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Mathematics. Our guest today is Lynn Gamwell, a lecturer in the history of art, science, and mathematics at the School of Visual Arts in New York. She has created, and I use the word advisedly, a book entitled Mathematics and Art, which not only should you get, you should proudly display in a prominent place when friends come to visit. If the friends don't pick it up and are entranced, then either get new friends or upgrade your current collection. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. Lynn, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, actually, I was invited to consider writing it by someone else. It was someone else's idea. I'd written a previous book on science and art for Princeton University Press. And when that was released, the math editor suggested I consider this writing a similar parallel book on math and art. And what I found with both books, both the science and art and the math of art, was that that there was a lot of modern and contemporary art that was inspired by science and mathematics.
That's actually one of the surprises that I got when I was reading your book. Your book includes the diverse fields of art, philosophy, mathematics, and physics. What is your educational background?
I have a bachelor's degree in philosophy and a doctorate in art history. And in math and science, I'm self-taught. And then, you know, and I could say about that, as far as my, I learned math and science on my own after, with some help, but, you know, occasionally from a tutor after I'd finished a doctorate. And what I found in, especially in the math books, was that it was difficult for me to understand some of the material because of the diagrams, which I felt from a visual point of view, coming from the art world, were not capturing the abstract idea. And so I vowed in this, in the book that you were talking about, the math and art book, to do a set of math diagrams that I felt would help the people in the art world understand these abstract concepts. And so that became a whole project for the book, if you understand. There's a set of math diagrams.
And they're very lovely diagrams. In fact, the entire book is lovely. But I think one of the things that we're going to touch on later in the conversation is the fact that the two different groups of people, namely the artists and the scientists, tend to not only see the same ideas in different ways, they look at pictures the different ways. Because when you described how difficult it was for you to understand the pictures, I'm thinking how difficult it is for me to understand abstract art. Anyway, let me ask you a question about your job. Your title is Lecturer in Mathematics, Science, and Art at the School of Visual Arts. What exactly do you teach as far as math and science goes?
Well, let me correct you. My title is I teach the history of math and science. I don't teach lab science. And so I'm teaching it from a historical perspective, and I'm linking it to the art of the era, okay? Because the math and science is describing reality, and artists are describing reality. So I link it to the artwork. These are art students.
No, go ahead. Because I was thinking, we teach history of mathematics as well, but it's probably more mathematically intensive than it is at the School of Visual Arts. But it's interesting to learn these things. At least you're exposing them to the things that we as scientists know and love.
Yeah, the book that the math and art book that I just that was just released. I mean, that'll be a textbook for a course that I teach. No, it'll be used as a textbook. It's got 13 chapters, you know, for a 15-week course. So that's the basic idea of it.
Well, I'm going to congratulate you if you can manage to get your students to get through that book in one semester, because for me it would be it would definitely be an undertaking. But I'm not as young as I used to be.
Well, they're already, I mean, it's a course I've taught for years, but without the book. So they're already getting through it all.
Oh, okay. Okay. Speaking of the book, it's really an amazingly beautiful coffee table book, and it doesn't look like you just threw it together overnight. How long did it take you to create this book?
Well, it was 12 years in the research and writing, and then 1 year in production. And let me say, too, it didn't start out to be a coffee table book. It was just going to be a book that my previous book on science and art is half the length and is never described as coffee table book. But the history of math, unlike science, it begins so early and it's global from the beginning. And so it took a lot of words and a lot of pictures. Anyway, the book kept growing. It wasn't my intention and the publisher definitely resisted it getting too big from the beginning. But in the end, it's a heavy book that's, you know, over 550 pages, and it's weighty.
It is that, and it's weighty in several senses of the word because it's deep. I mean, it's really a work of scholarship, and I commend you for sticking with it, because when I think of some of the projects, investigatory projects that I've been involved on, I looked at one question for 5 years, and that was, you know, that exhausted me. So I'm just amazed that you were able to stick with it. You must have had a wonderful feeling when you're finally sensing that the end is near.
Yeah, it was great to have a copy actually in my hands.
Yeah, I believe it. Just out of curiosity, since you said that you're planning on using this as a text when you teach your course, as you assembled the various chapters, did you test market it with your students to see how it worked with them?
Yes, I mean, I've been teaching this. I've been teaching the course, in just like the book for maybe 4 or 5 years, and I've taught a science and art course for. Since 2002, since the previous book came out. So, yes, I definitely experimented.
Well, I must admit, I'm heartened by the fact that at the College of Visual Arts, the potential budding artists are exposed to math and science, because we in math and science sort of feel that our subjects get short shrift whenever artists gather. So I'm glad to hear that that's the case.
Oh yes. Yeah, definitely. It's an art school that has humanities and math art requirements as part of it. And that's in a tradition that goes back to German education. I mean, American art schools are based on a curriculum that was imported after World War II. And it has... it's based in the Bauhaus School of Design, if you know, some of your readers or listeners might know. It's a long tradition in German education, which is what the School of Visual Arts and most art schools in America are based on.
That's very interesting. When I started looking at this book, I kept thinking of C.P. Snow's book, The Two Cultures, in which he thinks of the scientists and the artists as belonging to two very different groups with entirely different worldviews. Do you agree with Snow? Do you think of your book as a bridge between these two groups?
Well, when I think of Snow, I mean, he was focusing on the education of these two groups. Everybody's got the same worldview, you know. If anybody, he wrote this in 1959, as I recall, and he was in Britain, okay. And Britain in the 50s and 60s, it had a more traditional Beaux-Arts education that focused less on science. Anyway, I mean, that's a separate topic, but it's not like the Germanic. An American style of education for artists. I mean, I think he was looking primarily at education. Everybody in the 50s and today has a scientific worldview. Even if they go to mass on Sunday or temple on Saturday, if they woke up this morning with a toothache, they'd go to the dentist. we all have it.
And I have a dentist appointment later this afternoon, so thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, well, I mean, we all have that worldview. And it's just, you know, how much, and some of the artists, I should say too, in my book, I mean, we're all influenced by the scientific worldview. I mean, it's the view of nature that we live with. And in some of the artists that I, they're not students of mathematics. They are simply reflecting the world they live in, the culture they live in.
But it, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I can certainly get that. What was the most difficult aspect of creating this book?
Well, just the usual practical problems of, you know, finding time and keeping the complex record straight. But yeah, but just some of the practical things. I mean, of course, there's the intellectual issues were more or less difficult, but they were very engaging, and yeah, I mean, difficult projects are interesting. You know,
I think most people in math would agree with that statement.
It was very, very engaging, and as far as things that were problems, I would point to just the usual practical things that most anybody has with a project.
I guess that's reasonable. Since you begin in Stone Age times, your book covers over 5,000 years. Is there a historical focus to the book?
Yeah, the historical focus is modern and contemporary art. I mean, that's my field. As far as my own background as a historian, there's 13 chapters in the book, and the first chapter gives a historical broad-brushed overview from the Stone Age to around 1900. In other words, that gives the background. And then, and that's a very long chapter, and it's east and west, you know, that's very long. And then that's for anybody can read that. Any art student or any art person can read that and get just a sense of the basic approach of mathematics and how it's influences the arts. And then the other 12 chapters are on the modern era from, you know, say late 19th century to the present. And then I dip back into the past as needed for background in the other chapters. I could say too, there's a couple overarching themes. You want me to give those?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. One is the distinction between the philosophy and the practice of mathematics throughout history, because the practical aspects can get so complex that they're not really discussed in the general public of an artist, and so a lot of the impact is more philosophical. On what are numbers, as opposed to 2 and 2 is 4, the actual practice of arithmetic. Another theme is that I found there's a tension, dates to antiquity, and that we feel between the more rationalist accounts of the natural world. That are, operating according to deterministic laws of cause and effect. And in other words, that we can explain it all. We can understand it. And then the rebellions against such models and the math that's associated with them, rebellions against calculus as dehumanizing and as, we're not going to be able to figure it all out. You know, and anyway, I mean, those are themes that link this historical sweep.
I'll tell you, I think that's really interesting because it's a perspective you don't get when you study mathematics. And it's nice that somebody looks at these things from an overall, from sort of an overall perspective, like what are we doing? What are we talking about? Because in mathematics, you just do it. You don't talk about it.
Yeah, so, and where does it come from?
Yeah, and where is it going? Well, mathematics sort of looks a little at that. But speaking of mathematics, can you give a few examples from your book, perhaps, of the relation between mathematics and art?
Yeah, let me give you first an example where the artist is consciously using the math. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Love it.
Okay. And this is a contemporary Japanese artist, Tatsu Miyajima. And he's reflecting in his work a Taoist perspective. And this, of course, is ancient. Taoism in China, he's Japanese, but I mean, Taoism is Chinese in origin. But the view in antiquity, but is still practiced today in Asia. And so he's reflecting that today. And the Taoist view from ancient China is that the natural world is a balance of parts. And the yin yang, the hot, cold, plus, minus. And that they came into being by self-assembly, and that everything fits together, but they follow the way, the Tao. Tao means way, and it follows the way of nature. Okay, and so when we look at reality, we're trying to understand it. It's we look at it. We're looking for patterns that self-assemble, basically. Okay, and he symbolizes this in his work. You walk in and you look at the his work, and it's a grid. It's a blinking grid of lights. Okay, it's these light-emitting diodes, these LEDs. Okay, and so you're looking at a screen, and it's just columns and rows of lights, and some are on, some are off, and they're blinking. Okay. And if you stand there and look at it for a while, you might suspect that there's a pattern to it, but it's too complex for your eye and your mind to discern. You'd have to stand there for a long time. You might have to take notes and stuff. And he's doing this. It's like the natural world for him. It's a unity of fluctuating parts. There is an underlying pattern. He's programmed it, but it would be difficult to find, or you could find parts of it. Do you understand?
Yes, because as you were discussing this, I was thinking of a book that was written in the 1970s entitled The Tao of Physics, in which the author discusses that a lot of contemporary physics, and that was, you know, that's basically quantum mechanics, reflects this duality of which you speak. So it's not, it's a thought that has occurred to very, very different groups of people. It's occurred to artists, it's occurred to mathematicians, and it's occurred to physicists.
Yeah, you know, and I can't let that reference get by, though. I don't want your listeners to think we're endorsing this book. I mean, it's based on, I mean, the basic premise of the book, it's written by a physicist, as I recall.
Yes. Friedhof Capra.
Yeah, Capra. Yeah, he's Austrian. Viennese, but he wrote it when he was a visiting scholar at in Berkeley at the at UC Berkeley, and he was in some hot tubs and taking some LSD, and he's reflecting he's arguing for a link between quantum physics and the tradition of Taoism, Eastern mysticism. Frankly, I think he's trivializing a 2,000-year-old monastic tradition that Miyajima today is part of. He's basing it on throughout that book, he's quoting Heisenberg, Werner Heisenberg, who wrote a book on the philosophy of physics in the 50s. That inspired this Tao of the Tao of physics and other authors to make this kind of leap between the Eastern tradition and quantum mechanics. But anyway, I just want to go on record as not endorsing this book.
Well, I was the one who brought it up simply because I was reminded of it when you were talking about it. But why don't we get back to your book? And I'd like to say one of the things I enjoyed about your book was the appearance of themes that are common to both areas of mathematics and art. And I'd like to look at a few of them and start with symmetry, since it's so important in both.
Yeah, well, in symmetry, yeah, the math of symmetry, group theory, and that's a type of math that isn't known generally in the it's used throughout the sciences, but it's not known by the general public. I have found, and
I'm happy when the general public understands arithmetic well enough to use it.
Yeah, but they know arithmetic. They know the word arithmetic. They know the word geometry or calculus. They don't know the word group theory or what a group is. You know, I mean, it's much less known. But
that's certainly true.
Yeah, but anyway, I mean, but this is a good example because there were students of David Hilbert. They were doctoral students who did their dissertations on group theory at Göttingen. Hermann Weyl, he was German, and Andreas Spitzer, the Swiss mathematician, and they both had an interest in the arts, both of these guys, and they both published books on symmetry in the 30s and after that linked our analysis of symmetrical patterns in the natural world with patterns in the decorative arts, basically, and they were read by artists in Switzerland, in Zurich, and so on. In the sciences, it's used in crystallography and physics, cosmology, and again, they just applied it to the decorative arts, and these are artists that. These are mathematicians, I say, that the artist actually knew. Andreas Spitzer taught in Zurich, and he knew Max Bill's work. Max Bill is a Swiss graphic artist, beginning in the 30s, and died in the 1980s with his long career in Switzerland. He read Spitzer, and Spitzer knew his work. I mean, they eventually met. Carl Gerstner, who's still living, was the next generation. He also knew Andreas Spitzer. And so they definitely, this is a place where you've got artists creating work with symmetrical patterns and following worlds of transformation that are right out and using the vocabulary right out of group theory that knew these artists. The artist knew the physics, and can I throw in part of my research? I went to Switzerland because I couldn't find enough information about these. I just had a feeling, and I had read some things, but I couldn't find enough information from them that they had published or in secondary sources. And so I went there and was able to interview the nephew. David Spitzer, who's a physicist, a nephew of Andreas Spitzer, and his wife is the daughter of Hermann Weyl, and the son of Max Bill, Carl Gerstner, is still living, so I could talk to him, and other Swiss artists, and that was extremely fruitful, and I could do work, and I could research in archives there. It would have been impossible to do here. Because of it's not big enough archives to be copied and put on the internet and so on. So anyway, but I was able to really do a talk to the people that in one generation removed of the people that really did this linking. So it's a very, very good example. Max Bill, Carl Gerstner, Richard Paul Loza, doing work that they're all graphic artists doing work that is symmetrical, based in design, using group theory.
Well, I must admit that I'm happy to hear that these ideas have penetrated the artistic community, because there are some which are there's an appeal to symmetry. I think I once saw a study in which they looked at what makes very people attractive to the opposite sex, and symmetry of face turned out to be extremely important, which I found intriguing. But I know that mathematics and art get linked. Probably it starts with, at least it starts historically, I think, with perspective. And so maybe you could discuss that a little for us.
Yeah, well, the the invention of linear perspective you have in mind, right?
Yes.
And that's a very good example. I mean, it's an unusual example because it begins with artists and it's picked up by the math world. The perspective it's based on the first correct description of how we see that the eye is a passive receiver of light. Okay, that's a medieval Islamic scholar, Ibn al-Haytham. He publishes that, and then there are many Latin translations circulating in Florence and throughout Italy in the early 1400s, and that's the basis. That's what they're looking at. They're looking at the Latin translations, their hand translations of this medieval Islamic view of the eye. And then it's Filippo Brunelleschi, who is an architect, who in the 1430s designs linear perspective. So it's a very good example because it's a geometric projection from a point to a plane. The point is one eye, this passive receptor of light, and the light is reflected off a plane. And then he defines linear perspective as a planar. He's thinking of it like a window, the picture plane, as an intersection of that visual cone. And then it catches on. I mean, it fits the time because artists at the time are shifting their viewpoint from thinking of reality as it being in a faraway world and existing in the present right there in front of them. And so they want to present the saints and as existing in their world. An example of listeners may know is Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper. That's an example of a construction in using Brunelleschi's linear perspective. And then let me just say how it's picked up later. I mean, sure. Of course, we use it today, and artists that draw today in perspective use linear perspective. It's the correct way to do it. Linear perspective becomes of interest to mathematicians. They generalize it. You know, it's generalized first into projective geometry, not just a picture plane that's perpendicular to the floor like a painting, but one that's tipped to various angles. It's Poncelet, the French mathematician. And then it's generalized further onto planes that are not just tipped, but can be warped by Brouwer, the Dutch mathematician in the early 20th century, and becomes topology and to planes existing in any dimension.
You know, this has been very enlightening for me because I did not realize that when I think of topology, I think of it arising in a different way because I'm an analyst by nature. And so I think of topology as arising from questions of analysis. But of course, it can also be viewed as arising from questions of geometry. And I thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah. And let me give you an example of an artist today that use topology sort of without knowing it, if I can put it that way. I mean, because a lot of artists just get interested in patterns. This is an artist, Jim Sanborn, his name is. He does photography by projecting patterns. And in this case, they were concentric circles. So they're, you know, circles with a small and then larger and larger diameter, concentric circles of light. So it's a black and white, if you can get the idea, okay?
Okay.
They're just internecent. And he projected these patterns of concentric circles on a cliff in Ireland, and he projected it from about a mile away at night, okay? And so it's a pattern of concentric circles, and the surface that it's on is contiguous, which it has to be in topology, but it's very irregular. And so it makes a new pattern on this surface. And then he photographs this. He does a time-lapse photograph at night, if you can get the idea. And so these exquisite photographs of patterns of light on irregular surface. And it's a perfect example of Brouwer's topology.
One of the things that I think might interest viewers, or at least it certainly interests me since you brought it up, is whether or not there's a video that can be seen on the internet describing, you know, how these patterns unfold in his process of time-lapse photography, because I would certainly think he'd done that.
He may have, not that I know of, but it's just one click away to find out.
Well, I might take that click after the interview. Anyway, the concept of infinity is a far-reaching one, appearing in physics and philosophy as well as mathematics and art.
Yes. Well, it's a concept. The concept of infinity, I mean, it's needed for math because the numbers are. The counting numbers
go out of ways. Yes,
but it was avoided in some cases in the history of math because it easily leads to paradoxes and calculus was invented to be able to measure infinite quantities if you're measuring something that's in motion. But let's get to modern uses of infinity, because there are uses of it in our modern concept of infinity is from Georg Cantor from the late 19th century in his work on doing arithmetic using infinite sums. And as far as the examples of artists using infinity, I think one of the most interesting ones are in these monuments to the dead, where I think let me describe one for, and then I'll say how it relates to infinity. This is one by Constantin Brancusi, who's a Romanian artist. He's from Romania, but he spent most of his life in Paris. But he did a monument to the Romanians who had died in World War I, and he did it for his hometown. And it's a column that it calls it infinite column, but it's a column made of a repeating form, and you get to the top, and it's only half of the form, and so you continue in your imagination. It's comparing the infinity of time or in space of continuing up in with man's finitude. I mean, I think this is part of the fascination and of the concept of infinity and the reflection. Another is here I'm in New York. You know, the Tribute in Light, after 9/11, after the Twin Tower collapse, the assemblage of these two groups of lights, but it looks like two beams of light, and it just continues as if forever. Okay, and again, it's a monument associated with death and with man's finitude. And I think it's a good example of the contrast that in the visual arts.
I think that when we start thinking about infinity, it's a concept that has occurred in it to practically, you know, to probably every civilization, and they look at it differently. And certainly it's interesting for me to find out how artists think about it, because, of course, my thinking is shaped by Cantor and by the mathematicians who both preceded and followed Cantor. And infinity is sort of rigorously defined in mathematics. You don't so much think about its consequences, you think about what you can do with it. And it's one of the things that when you think about the way an artist might look at infinity is they might see it with a sense of awe that perhaps it loses when you start studying it mathematically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're almost a direct quote from the American artist Robert Smithson. He was a land artist, and he talked about this is a remark he made during the space program. He said, you know, the space program, that it's we're trying to conquer space, and that we should think of it like Pascal, and then be terrified of the infinity of space and time. I just thought it was, you know, it's a way of looking at infinity from a more aesthetic point of view.
Well, my feeling is that with the advent of series such as Star Wars and Star Trek, I don't think we look at it with the terror that perhaps Smithson thought we should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And philosophers of old have, like Pascal, mathematicians.
<yeah. laughs> anyway, getting to another portion of mathematics, calculus is the mathematics of change. And I think many mathematicians think that mathematics changed drastically when it shifted from an examination of the static, such as what geometry does, to the dynamic, which is what calculus does. And is there a similar development in art that marked a change from static to dynamic?
I can't think of one right at that time. I can give you an example of a. Let me give you my best shot.
Sure.
From that time frame, is the contemporary of Galileo's, Artemisia Gentileschi, her name was. She was a court painter in Italy. She was a friend of Galileo's for many decades, and she knew his studies on motion. Okay, and she did two paintings of Judith slaying Holofernes. Judith was a Jewess in the Old Testament who she was a widow, and she was killing a Holofernes was a general who was going to attack her town, and she slays him. She sneaks into his tent at night and slays him with his own sword. And in her earlier depiction, she did a couple paintings of this. In her earlier depiction, she sort of symbolizes his head gets cut off, and there's like an arc circle, like a half circle of blood coming out. Okay, but after she learned from Galileo that blood that a projectile moves in a parabolic path, she incorporated this into her later paintings of it. And the blood oozes out in sprinkles and in paths that are parabolic. Okay, now I think it's going for more static in the sense that it's more just a symbol of moving fluid to really looking like what it is, which is a dynamic flow of blood.
Well, I guess, you know, when I think of change in art, and admittedly, I'm not well versed in art, but of course, I think of Escher, because there's a lot of change in Escher and transformation. And I'm sure that it antedates Escher, but I think Escher does just such a fabulous job with all this stuff.
You mean showing going from one thing to another, from a bird to a fish?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. He began doing that by studying Islamic tiling patterns, tessellation.
That's a concept in mathematics.
Yeah, no, it's a yeah, of course. And he began before that. You know, he's Dutch, and he didn't like Mondrian and abstract art, and so he left Amsterdam and went to Italy, where they still did good old fashioned portraits and landscapes. And he by chance. And so his early work is all very realistic. And then by chance, he went to the Alhambra in Granada in Spain, which is Islamic, and saw these tiling patterns. And that's where it starts for him. I mean, that's where his first work is on tessellation. And this movement from one form to another is done by the Islamic tilers in that building. Okay, and we have drawings by Escher after that building that are, you know, dated, they're in the mid-1930s. But that's the beginning of his math work. And then he goes on, as you know, to to study other types of math, but he begins with tessellation that shows the movement from one form to another.
Well, as far as I can recall, Picasso sort of started out as a realist also and gradually evolved.
Yeah. He began as a sort of symbolist. So, you know, in Barcelona and with his early paintings of clowns and guitarists and so on. And then it was after he moved to Paris that his work became more abstract. I mean, he became more, there was a move in Paris more into, it's not non-objective. I mean, there's still pictures of things. A Picasso cubist work is of an object. It's, you know, of a guitar or something seen, but it is more abstracted. But his early work is figurative, and his later work is figurative. He returns to figuration, Picasso, in the 20s. He does a whole classical work. He's drawing again from the figure.
One of the things in your book is that you often refer to Platonism in both art and mathematics. And I've seen that expression before, not really understanding it. What is Platonism and how does it manifest itself in art and mathematics?
Well, it's a view in the philosophy of mathematics. And it's named for Plato, and I mean he indeed wrote about it. I mean, ancient Platonism isn't exactly the same as contemporary, but it's, you know, it's basically the same idea. He wrote about what abstract objects are like. He called them the forms, but thinking just of mathematics, like what are numbers? What is a sphere? We all know what that is. You know, a sphere is all points equidistant from a point. And he asked, well, do they actually exist somewhere? And he asserted that they did, that we never see a sphere, a perfect sphere. We see spherical objects like the moon, but they're not perfect spheres. But that they are somewhere. They're outside time and space. Okay, and so it's a view about what you say in philosophy, ontology, what they are, and how we know them. Plato wrote about, in other words, epistemology in philosophy. In other words, how do I know a sphere? Gave you Euclid's definition of a sphere, you understood it, and all our listeners do. Okay, we all how is that possible? If we can't see it or touch it, it's we do it by intuition or cognition. Is the translation of Plato's term, and so that's the old view. You know, it's a view about what abstract objects like numbers, triangles, spheres are, and how we know them. When we say Platonism today. The controversial question is almost all what they are is ontology. You know, do they exist or not? Okay, because most mathematicians assume that they exist somewhere. I mean, they take it as given that their work is about a structure that already exists. In other words, they're discovering it as opposed to creating it. I mean, that's, you know, somebody's done surveys on this. You know, it's like 75% of most working mathematicians would say that they sit down and they're not making it all up. It's not all in their head, that they're describing something that is pre-existing. In the arts, the way this is manifest, Platonism in the arts, is that artists like Max Bill, who we mentioned before, I mean, or P.A. Mondrian, Henry Moore are examples. They're trying to visualize underlying forms in nature, like with Henry Moore, the structure of the human body in just simplified forms, or Max Bill just doing a circle or a sphere or a triangle, or a Mondrian just doing squares or rectangles. Well, what is it about? These are the underlying forms of reality of the natural world, and they're they're imperfect copies of triangles or circles that exist outside time and space.
I'd like to skip a little bit ahead to find out how creating the book affected you. For instance, did you make any discoveries about art that surprised you?
Well, let me give you one that surprised me about Platonism. Okay.
Sure.
Okay. Because abstract objects, exist outside time and space, and that Platonism is linked with, Plato thought they were divine, all of the forms were gods, they were divine, and it gets linked with Judaism, which of course pre-exists, exists before Plato, but it gets linked with the Judeo-Christian tradition, and so there's a long association of Platonism with religion, and with Christianity, particularly with the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, the Abrahamic religions, okay, and as building temples with to the God of Abraham with a spherical dome because it's representing the perfect sphere beyond time and space, and so on. What I found was that there's a lot of resistance to Platonism today because of its long association with religion, that people are uncomfortable with it. People in the mathematics world. And I found myself viewed with suspicion, like I was a religious missionary or something, disguised as a scholar, because I was getting a sympathetic reading to these historical documents. In other words, I always try to put myself in the place of the person who's holding this view, and I'm completely secular myself. But I came to see it just gave me a feeling for how much resistance there is to the tradition of Platonism because of its long association with religious. It just touches a nerve. In scholars who were otherwise dispassionate.
Okay. Well, I think that, I think that things that reflect upon that sort of can possibly touch upon religion conceivably do touch nerves with some people. And we're certainly seeing that in today's world. But did you also make any surprising discoveries about math and science while you were writing the book?
Yeah, I had studied physics. I mean, I had this, I studied physics on my own, and just realizing how much that's taught as physics is really philosophy of physics. It's interpretation of the physical data. The example is the Copenhagen interpretation, and I know that now that's not taught as the only view, but there's still a lot of it around. And just how much it was taught as the gospel truth from the time Born Heisenberg announced it in 1927 to around the 60s, after the German defeat in World War II, and that there are other ways to interpret the same laboratory data. I'm used to such dogmatism in the art world. Artists are always saying, my art is the art. This is the way it's got to be, and writing manifestos. But I just expected to find a more cool-headed rationalism in the laboratory.
Well, I think what you'd probably find is that a lot of mathematicians and scientists don't think of it so much as dogmatism, but more along the lines of the fact that science is a very, very conservative enterprise. And if you've got something that seems to be reasonably good, you don't just shove it aside until you've found either a viable alternative, which I don't think there was to the Copenhagen interpretation. The parallel universes interpretation didn't arise until the late 1950s. So maybe it was the only player in the philosophy of physics game at that time.
No, it absolutely wasn't. At the same 1927 meeting that Heisenberg announce the uncertainty principle, and the Copenhagen interpretation was also on the platform when in the figure of Bohr. Louis de Broglie, a French physicist, gave a paper at the same conference to the same audience with Einstein in the sitting there, that gave an alternative, which is known today as the de Broglie Bohm, after David Bohm, interpretation, that gives a different alternative to the Copenhagen interpretation.
Well, okay, okay. I know Bohm from, but I think Bohm did most of his work in the 50s, also.
Yes, but he was continuing the 1927 de Broglie paper. Okay.
Well, that sometimes happens in mathematics and physics, that it takes ideas a while to emerge, especially if one idea is championed by people who are recognized experts. And certainly de Broglie was a recognized expert, but I don't think you'd put him on the same level as Heisenberg and Bohr.
Well, you'd put him on the same level as Einstein, though. Is Einstein supported the de Broglie? Einstein was there. It was in the 1927 audience. I mean, this is the source of the famous Bohr-Einstein debates. The debates that start on the ultimate nature of reality. Where is the moon there even when I'm not looking at it? These debates. What's the nature of reality? Is observation crucial or not? You know, this is when it begins.
Yeah, and it's also a central question. I'd like to take advantage of what may be the only opportunity that I will ever have to talk to an art expert and ask one or two questions that have puzzled me. And I've always wanted to ask an art expert, and maybe other people, other listeners would relish my asking these as well. So I'm going to hit you with a couple of questions, and then I'm going to ask you what you have planned for the future.
Okay.
And so the first one is, do you consider what Jackson Pollock did artistic? Even though some people may find it attractive, is it a creative endeavor?
And let me be clear. So, and what you're referring to,
throwing paint at canvas.
Okay. The short answer is yes. And what you're referring to are Pollock's so-called drip paintings, and they were made by lying a canvas on the floor of his studio, a very large canvas, and dripping paint. You know, movies dripping a canvas. The short answer is yes. But let me make an observation about your question, okay? And
sure.
The whole way you pose it to me, okay? Because this is a perfect example of the C.P. Knowles, the C.P. Snow divide that we talked about before. You know, your education is in mathematics. Mine is in art, okay? And so according to Snow and our culture, there's a fence dividing us. Right? Okay. I look over into your world and there are a lot of things I don't understand. I see weird things. You look over into my world and there are things you don't understand.
Like, absolutely.
Like this Pollock.
Which is why I asked it.
Okay. Let me give you some advice. Okay. Let me give you a pep talk. You're asking the question in a hostile way, okay? And you're not going to learn much in this way. My advice is to keep an open mind and heart. And what you should ask me is not, why is this guy throwing paint? Okay, you should ask me, you know, can you explain this to me? You know, this is, I don't understand. In other words, be open-minded about it, okay? Don't, if you ask me with suspicion, cynicism, is this art? You know, you're limiting your ability to grasp something that's new. You know, hey, this looks like a child could do it. You walk away with nothing, okay? It's like if I ask you, I don't understand E equals MC, the equivalence of mass and energy. Who is this guy Einstein? What is he? Is he going to get away with something? You know, it's not, take my advice. You know, approach with what you don't know with some sympathy, curiosity, and an open mind and open heart. Okay. And then, you know, if you do all this work to understand art, you know, are you guaranteed, you know, when you go to the art museum next time, you go to the Museum of Modern Art and see this painting, are you going to get some happiness or some pleasure? Are you going to see something aesthetic? No, but if you're not happy with it, you'll know why. You'll understand the work. Your goal isn't pleasure. Your goal is knowledge. And knowledge is power. You know, and so anyway, that's my pep talk.
Okay, and my comment on this would be my goal of going to an art museum is for pleasure. That I want to see Monet. I want to see Impressionists. I want to see also people from other generations and how they thought of art. And I'm also willing to admit that I don't know everything. And I'm one of the reasons that I asked that question was because Pollock is not only well regarded. Jackson Pollock paintings sold for $140 million, something that is absolutely never going to happen with me for anything that I do in my entire life. So obviously people value it and consider it a creative endeavor. And I was hoping to find out why. I didn't, but I appreciate your answering the question. And I'd like to conclude the interview by asking you what you're going to do next, because you've obviously spent a tremendous amount of time on this book and maybe you want to rest or maybe you have other projects in mind.
No, I'm just going to take a break. And
can't blame you at all. Yeah. Nothing in the future?
No, I'm thinking of maybe writing something for children.
Wow. that's a considerable jump, and I wish you well, because believe me, these are, you know, when you talk, I've spent some time with children, although I have none of my own, and you're hitting a group of people that are most receptive to what most receptive. They're interested in the sciences, they're interested in the arts, and I'm sure that you'll have a lot to enrich them with. Lynn, I thank you very much. And once again, I'd just like to conclude by saying to our audience that Lynn's book, Mathematics and Art, A Cultural History, is just a beautiful, beautiful book and well worth the time that you spend looking at it. And Lynn, thank you very much for the interview.
My pleasure.